From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the shoe has dropped. China has responded to the U.S., adding additional tariffs to Chinese goods coming into the U.S. This was last Friday, by raising tariffs on some American imports today. Earlier today, President Trump warned that China would be hurt very badly if they didn't make a deal on trade. But in New York, there was a big sell-off on the stock market at the opening. Joining us from New York, NPR business and economics reporter Jim Zaroli. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Robin.
And first, some background. What kind of products are the Chinese putting their tariffs on, and how will that affect American companies doing business there?
Well, the tariffs that China announced are not going to have a huge effect on the U.S. economy because China just doesn't buy that much from the U.S. Mm. The U.S. sells more to China than the other way around. Now, it is true that a lot of American companies do business with China, but they tend to manufacture within the country itself, so they're not going to be affected by tariffs on imports. Now, certain sectors of the U.S. economy are going to be hurt. A lot of what the U.S. exports to China are agricultural products, things like peanuts, sugar, wheat, beef and chicken. American farmers are already suffering. They've already been hurt by an earlier round of tariffs. Soybean farmers in particular saw their revenue just plummet. Now, starting on June 1st, they can still sell to China, but there will be this extra tax tacked on, and it will range from 5 to 25% of the cost of what's getting shipped. So that will make it harder for American farmers to compete against farmers from other countries. So they're going to be hurt even more.
Well, on Fox News on Sunday, White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow acknowledged this, that Americans are going to be hurt. This is contrary to what the president has been saying, that American consumers won't be paying more for goods imported from China. Let's listen to host Chris Wallace with Larry Kudlow.
It's not China that pays tariffs. It's the American importers, the American companies that pay what in effect is a tax increase and oftentimes passes it on to U.S. consumers.
Fair enough. In fact, both sides will pay. Both sides will pay in these things.
Well, so he says both sides will pay. Apparently, with China now imposing tariffs, there's a little more truth to that. But the president is still tweeting out there's no reason for the U.S. consumer to pay the tariffs, which take effect on China today. He went in to say that this was proven because there were only there was a little bit more that was paid by the U.S. with tariffs, but China had to pay a lot more with tariffs because they subsidized so many products. And then he went on to say, but tariffs can be completely avoided if you buy from a non-tariffed country or you buy the product inside the U.S. What is the sense here of who's right?
Well, the president has been saying this for a long time, and it is not true. I mean, he says tariffs are paid by the Chinese, and tariffs are paid by the company that imports products into the United States. They are paid when they go through customs at the port. So the importer is ultimately responsible for them. Now, importers can absorb the costs themselves, which means their profit is lowered, or they can try to get their Chinese suppliers to lower their costs, their prices. That does happen sometimes. Or they can pass the tariff on to their customers. So it's true these new tariffs are collected and the money goes into the U.S. Treasury. But for the most part, the money isn't coming from China. It is coming from U.S. businesses and consumers. It's coming from you and me. It's like a tax increase on everyone who buys anything from China, which, you know, is, of course, is everyone in the United States.
Right. Well, and the goal of all of this, we have to remind ourselves that this, you know, this tariff war is because the president is trying to lean on China to come to a new deal with the U.S. Is there a sense that this is working, or did China call the president's bluff? I mean, you had people last week, Democrats, applauding President Trump for the pressure he was putting on China. So what's your sense here of what's happening?
You know, I don't know. It seems like a lot of this may be just negotiating ploys. I mean, the Chinese tariffs don't take effect until June 1st. The U.S. tariffs do take effect right away, but they only apply to products shipped after last Thursday. They don't apply to products that are in transit, you know, floating out there in a cargo ship somewhere. It typically takes around 2 weeks for products to get here. So there is – we have this grace period. China and the United States have a couple of weeks at least to resolve these issues before the tariffs take effect. And both countries are continuing to talk although no meetings have been set up. So as I say, this may be just kind of a bluff.
Well,
but it has to be said there are some very big issues on the table still, some serious sticking points. And there is this big political factor. I mean, neither country wants to be seen like it's giving in, especially China, which is really afraid of looking like it's giving in to pressure from the United States. So there is time to stop this runaway train, but it's going to take a lot of effort.
Well, there's another political factor. I'm on the president's Twitter feed right now, and I see someone writing him saying, soybean futures are the lowest they've been in 12 years. You're decimating our farmers while creating a tax for consumers. So there's the domestic politics to consider as well. Jim Zaroli, NPR business and economics reporter, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, now to Florida, where the legislature wrapped up its session this month with a host of controversial bills. For one thing, starting this fall, teachers will be eligible to carry guns in schools. And for another, the 1.4 million ex-felons who had their voting rights restored by Florida voters in November are now facing new restrictions before they can vote. Joining us now is Lynn Hatter, who's news director at WFSU in Tallahassee. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And let's start with this gun bill. How is this going to work? Which teachers and school officials will be able to carry a gun, and what kind of training will they get?
Well, the program is voluntary for districts, and all classroom teachers are now eligible for it. Previously, it was those teachers with other duties, like someone who was a science teacher and a coach or administrators. Teachers would have to go through about 130-some-odd hours of training, and about half of those hours, 80 of those hours, are directly in firearms instruction, and that includes some time doing active shooter training. They'll also have to have additional background checks and undergo a psychological exam, and they'd have to do yearly recertification just to keep their skills up to date and current.
And school districts would need to decide for themselves whether they want teachers to carry guns. Do we know how many are planning to sign on to this?
25 districts so far have approved participating in the Guardian program, and there's another 14 or so that are considering it. So that's more than half of the school districts in the state. Most others have said that they won't be participating, but it's important to note that those that are going forward are in largely rural areas where it's very hard for a sheriff's deputy or law enforcement to sort of get out to those schools. Mm-hmm. And so we've had most of our rural districts that have signed on to this.
Now, there are concerns we've heard a lot about it, that this kind of law could lead to more violence, and in particular that minority students could be wrongfully shot by a teacher, maybe in a misunderstanding.
Yeah, we have heard a lot about that, and there have been many reports about that happening in other states. There was a teacher that barricaded himself in a classroom in Georgia and fired a gun. So that was a concern that was raised by Democrats in this process. I recently spoke to our Lieutenant Governor, Jeanette Nunez, and she said, well, that's why we have the psychological exam in there, to make sure that a teacher is emotionally prepared to carry out this duty. But that is not easing those concerns at all, and you continue to hear them from people who are adamantly opposed to this, especially teachers. Teachers don't like this at all.
How much will these guns and the training cost the state?
So there was about $67 million that were appropriated for this last year. $57 million of that has rolled over to this current school year. So you've got about $57 million on hand just to administer this program. And that would cover increased insurance costs, guns, the guns themselves. So there's a lot of money that has been put forward to that. But a lot of it came because very few districts actually implemented it last year. So a lot of that money is rollover.
Let me ask you about something else the legislature passed this month. Voters approved an amendment last November in Florida to restore voting rights for more than a million people with felony convictions. But then this month, the Republican-led legislature added some restrictions. What are those changes?
Well, that means the payment of all court-ordered restitution fees and fines. Lawmakers want people who want their voting rights back. You have to pay it all in order to be able to register to vote. And some people have called this a poll tax. Mm-hmm. You've seen that term sort of thrown out there. But those are the restrictions. You have to pay it all back before you can register to vote.
Now, what are Republicans saying about adding these restrictions? Because this was something that was passed overwhelmingly by the voters to restore the voting rights for felons.
Well, Republicans said that they needed to clarify what voters intended. Supporters of this amendment said the legislature didn't have to do anything, that it was self-executing. But the big thing that Republicans pointed to was an argument before the Florida Supreme Court where lawyers for the group that sponsored the amendment said it indeed intended for all court fines and fees and restitution to be paid. And so Republican lawmakers have pointed to those arguments and have said, see, this is what even supporters of the amendment said that it would do. It's important to note that that language is not in the amendment itself. But again, Republicans have pointed to what happened before the Florida Supreme Court and said, this is what you get.
And just looking at the politics of this, this was expected to be something that would probably help Democrats, this giving the felons the right to vote again. This now will probably be more helpful to Republicans to make them pay all these fines before they vote.
Very much so. You have people who say, you know, this is yet another attempt by Republicans in power to limit Democratic votes. But again, this is probably something that's likely heading back to court. And already the ACLU of Florida has said as soon as Governor Ron DeSantis signs this bill, it will likely be filing a lawsuit. So, you know, we're going back to sort of where this issue all started, which was in a court.
Lynn Hatter, news director at WFSU in Tallahassee. Thank you.
Thank you.
It opens with the line, it's worse, much worse than you think. And that might be the most cheery thing you'll read in David Wallace Wells' new book, The Uninhabitable Earth, about the fast-approaching, full-on effects of global warming. One review is titled, The End is Near. David's op-ed in the New York Times was titled, It's Time to Panic. Remember the Kyoto Protocol back in 1997? Well, a 2-degree Celsius temperature increase was pronounced the upper limit for global warming. It was declared the threshold of catastrophe. Participants said, we will not cross that line. Well, in the 20 years since, we've produced more emissions than the 20 years before. So, like some crazed auctioneer, we now shout, 3 degrees, 3 degrees, and no more. But what if we can't stop global warming at 3? Because if we can't, we're cooked. David Wallace Wells joins us from New York. David, welcome. Even though you've caused many a nightmare, this is a tough read.
Well, yeah, just trying to spread the news that the scientists have been doing for so long.
Trying to spread that news. Look, you, though, have only been working on this for 3 years, and you were not an environmentalist. In fact, you're very candid, not an animal or nature lover. I mean, tell us a little more about how you were when you came to this.
Well, I'm a journalist who's interested in the near future, and I'm also a lifelong New Yorker, which meant that I spent most of my life, you know, I was concerned about climate change. I knew it was an important issue, but I was deluded in the sense that I felt I lived in an urban fortress outside of nature in the modern world, and that while there were people elsewhere on the planet who were going to be really in harm's way from some of these impacts, that I wasn't going to be one of them, and probably most of the people I loved weren't going to be among them. And as a result, I thought, you know, this is an important issue, but it's not an all-encompassing, all-governing issue. The deeper I got into the research, just as a journalist, the more I realized it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And every aspect of life, even those that we take so eternally for granted as permanent features of the world, are subject to the forces of nature. So when I walk down the street on the concrete street, I look up at steel buildings, I'm still living in nature. And especially if you're on the coast, you're vulnerable from sea level. But really, that's just the start. You know, projections estimate that if we don't change course on global warming, we could have a global GDP that's 30% smaller than it would be without climate change. That's an impact that's twice as big as the Great Depression, and it would be permanent. We could have twice as much war as we have today because there's a relationship between temperature and conflict. Our agricultural yields could be only half as bountiful, and we'd be using that half as much food to feed 50% more people. There are public health issues. There's a relationship between temperature and mental illness. There's an effect on cognitive performance. Really, everywhere you look, wildfires, extreme weather, hurricanes, droughts, heat waves, every aspect of life as we know it on this planet is changing already. The planet is already hotter than it's ever been in all of human history, and it will surely change more, which means that everything we know about human life and human civilization grew up under conditions that no longer preside, and we're living in a different enough environment, it may even be better to think already that we're living on a different planet. And given where we're headed, things are going to change even faster, even more dramatically in the decades ahead.
Okay, well, see, and your book reads that way, unrelenting, line after line after line, just shorn, you know, sharp fact about what the preponderance of science says is to come, and quickly, because right at the beginning, you bust a lot of myths. You know, there's a thinking that, well, climate change has started around the Industrial Revolution when we started spoiling nature. But no, you say it started around the same time as Seinfeld, and more than half of the carbon exhaled into the atmosphere by burning carbon fuels has been emitted in the last 3 decades. So since sort of Al Gore and the word ecology and all of that stuff became part of our language, it's worse.
Yeah, it's really amazing to think I'm 36 years old, which means my life contains this whole story. I have memories that are more than 30 years old. I remember driving and flying more than 30 years ago. And since I formed those memories, we've done more damage to the climate than in all of the centuries, all of the millennia before in human history. That's a really dispiriting fact to know in terms of how powerful knowledge is, because this is the same period of time since the UN established its IPCC climate change body and really advertised to all of the leaders of the world that this was a pressing, dramatic problem. But if those 30 years have brought us from a stable climate to the brink of catastrophe, which is where we are now, we have about that much time again to avert some of these worst scenarios.
30 years.
Which means 30 years ahead of us. And that means really, again, it's not just the story of the first half of that story that's going to take place in my lifetime. It's the second half, too. This is a drama of a scale that really we only used to understand or recognize in mythology or theology. The main driver of the future climate of the planet is what we do. And all of us are protagonists in that story and will determine what kind of future not just our children live in, but our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. That is how consequential the decades ahead of us will be.
You quote ecological theorist Timothy Morton, who calls this idea of global warming a hyper-object. It's just too big for us to grasp. We put it into sort of metaphorical terms. There are people who are out-and-out deniers. But putting that aside, you know, what should we do? And you seem to be agreeing with Steven Pinker that while making your own personal changes about whether or not you're going to drink out of a plastic bottle or take an airplane flight, you know, that's all well and good. You're not against people making moral choices, but that's hardly going to make a dent in 30 years. What is needed instead?
My short answer is political change producing policy change. We need such dramatic interventions in every sector of our world, from our energy, to our transportation, to our infrastructure, our agriculture. Absolutely every aspect of modern life has a carbon footprint, and we need to not just reduce those carbon footprints, we need to eliminate them entirely.
But in 30 years, in 30 years.
Yeah, I think most scientists would say we need to zero out on carbon globally by about 2050 in order to have a chance of stabilizing the planet below this threshold of a catastrophe. I think it's unlikely that we do that, but that's not a reason for slowing down now. I think it's really important to understand that this is not a binary system. It's not a matter of whether we pass that threshold or not. It's not a matter of whether we reach a hellish climate scenario or not. Every tick upward of temperature produces more suffering, more pain, and every tick that we can avoid will make the world a better place in the future. So while I think it's unrealistic that we entirely zero out on carbon by 2050, I think we should marshal as many resources as we possibly can to achieve that goal. And for me, that means policy action, because the truth is you and I could fly less, we could eat less red meat. That could have some very trivial impact on the global emissions pie. But if we're really trying to, say, zero out on carbon from flying, that will require an entirely different kind of jet running on an entirely different kind of fuel. And that will require significant research and development, and also probably legislation and regulation that will require it. The story of climate change is so big that we can't solve it through small actions. We need a big policy response.
Well, that's disconcerting, because at least in the current administration, there's, you know, been a move away from that. But of course, people can choose to think about it going into the 2020 elections. But meantime, talking about some of those policy changes, you say, you know, farmers have to be made to feed their cattle seaweed to cut down on methane. You mentioned concrete, walking down the street on concrete. If concrete were a country, you say it's, what, the third emitter of emissions? That's how much it holds on to. So it seems like you're saying come up with a replacement for cement.
Yeah, I think we need to solve all of those problems, and those problems are really everywhere. But truly everywhere you look in the world, every time you turn on the light, every time you get into a car, every time you turn on the television, every time you sit down to dinner, you're imposing some kind of carbon cost on the future. And unfortunately, as I said earlier, in order to really stabilize the climate, we can't just reduce those carbon emissions. We need to eliminate them entirely. We're at a global atmospheric carbon concentration right now of about 411 or 412 parts per million. Scientists believe anything above 350 parts per million is dangerous, and we're adding to that concentration every year. We need to actually work in the other direction and take carbon out of the atmosphere, which is really complicated and probably quite expensive, and we haven't yet begun to even undertake that project either.
Well, Evelyn, you talk about how maybe there's already technology being talked about, sucking carbon out of the air and sequestering it in the ground. Maybe there's technology that will be invented, you know, that might save humanity. Maybe humanity will evolve so that it's less human, so that there's more of a technological aspect to ourselves that helps us survive. But then we really are not on the planet the way we were.
Well, I think that we will be on a different planet no matter what path we choose, which is to say, even if we take quite dramatic action and really transform our trajectory on climate change, which is possible, everything is within our control, everything is up to us, it's not outside of our power. But even if we do that, we will be left with a world that is dramatically shaped by climate change, because it will mean huge new plantations of solar panel plants. It will mean plantations of carbon capture technology, which suck carbon out of the atmosphere. It will mean an entirely new infrastructure. It will mean new kinds of airplanes, new kinds of public transportation. It'll mean a new approach to diet and agriculture. Absolutely everything needs to be transformed and will be transformed either by the force of climate change or by the force that we put into avoiding climate change. Now, thankfully, there's still time to imagine a world that is made prosperous and fulfilling and just through climate action.
That's David Wallace Wells. He's someone who didn't think much about climate change, as he said. His new gripping page-turner is Uninhabitable Earth, the scientific thinking about climate change tomorrow. What are some of the effects? David's detail is incredible.
The thing that scares me most in a kind of reflexive animal way is the effect of climate change and temperature rise on our bodies. Temperature affects cognitive performance. It affects emotional well-being and mood. It affects the rates of autism and ADHD in developing children. The number of days that a baby spends in the womb over 90 degrees can be seen on its lifetime earnings.
More with David Wallace Wells tomorrow, here and now.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that is designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Ember Wave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, cold restaurants, after a workout, at home, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com. Emberwave, balance through temperature.
Chickens are a common sight in many suburban backyards, and cities, including New York and Chicago, also allow them. Now there's an effort in Philadelphia to legalize them again. WHYY's Hima Nakandi explains.
Luis Martinez fixes his motorcycle in his backyard in northern Philadelphia on a Friday afternoon. Chickens roam freely around him.
I keep them because that's a part of my tradition.
Martinez grew up in a part of Puerto Rico where he says it's normal to see chickens unrestrained.
I want to teach the little kids here, they never saw a chicken in her life in their own environment.
7-year-old Annalise Franco says she's fascinated by her feathered neighbors.
They have baby chickens, and they give us eggs.
Still, the neighborhood's beloved chickens, which have been around for at least 5 years, are illegal in Philadelphia. The birds were effectively banned in 2004 through legislation that placed restrictions on what farm animals people could keep in less than 3 acres. The bill cited the smell and noise of backyard farm animals as concerns. Now, there's a bill in the city council to reverse the ordinance. In North Philadelphia, residents like Iris Rodriguez admit the issue is complicated. The roosters can be loud.
They don't have a schedule to sing. They sing at any hour, 1 in the afternoon, 3 in the morning. They crow at any hour.
The city's animal care and control team gets at least a dozen calls related to chickens a year. Here's spokeswoman Morgan Polly.
We'll usually get complaints in when people are getting frustrated with hearing chickens in their neighborhood, in their vicinity, because they can be quite loud.
Fines start at $25, and the city's Department of Licenses and Inspections will step in on the rare occasion a resident doesn't fix the situation. Though there's no official group working to keep the ban, some residents have raised concerns about disease online. Veterinarian Megan Nichols is with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She investigates multi-state salmonella and E. coli outbreaks linked to contact with animals.
We see a lot of new backyard flock owners who get sick. And often this is because they might not be aware of the germs that poultry have, and they might not remember to wash their hands every time that they interact with the poultry.
The bacteria can be found in chicken droppings in coops, chicken feathers, or beaks. And you can't tell if a chicken is infected by looking at it. Maureen Breen is one of the people leading the effort to legalize hens in Philadelphia. She's president of Philadelphia Backyard Chickens and has tried to get the city to lift its ban for years. She's open to the regulation of chickens, like banning crowing roosters and limiting the number of hens in a home. But she says forbidding hens outright is a waste.
If there's somebody who's got a couple nice hens in her backyard and a neighbor doesn't like the person, they call it in, we have to waste our city resources, sending the animal care and control team out. Some people go through zoning variances. Some people have gone to court. And this is not something that we want to spend our city resources on.
Breen says hens are relatively quiet and are a good source of food. And you don't need a rooster to lay eggs.
You can grow all the tomatoes you want, but you're not going to get any protein. Most cities have legal hens. Philadelphia is one of the few that does not. So it really seems like we should get that problem corrected.
Breen and her group stress the importance of knowing how to care for your backyard flock. But they say it's time for the city council to revisit the ordinance because people are keeping chickens despite the current ban. They estimate some 5,000 chickens are already in the city. Their bill remains in committee without a hearing date. The council session ends in June. For Here and Now, I'm Ximena Condi.
There's more rain in the forecast this week for parts of the country that have been soaked. Richmond, Texas got more than 14 inches of rain over the last several days. There's been flash flooding in Mississippi, Texas, and Louisiana. And the heavy rainfall has contributed to rising waters in parts of the Mississippi River. Later this month, Baton Rouge, Louisiana is expected to break a record for the longest river flood event since 1927. Chelsea Braisted is a city columnist for NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. She joins us now. Chelsea, you woke up over the weekend to ankle-deep water in your neighborhood, which is directly across from the French Quarter. Tell us what it was like.
Yeah, so basically I just got a phone call at about 6 in the morning from my neighbor, and I was asleep, so my first thought was, oh, my neighbor's calling me in the morning. This must be a mistake. But, then I remembered, of course, that the weather had been really rough overnight, and so I knew exactly what he was calling for as soon as, my brain kicked in. Walked outside and the water was over my ankles in the street, and we had to get our cars out of the way to make sure that we didn't end up with flooded out cars again. So it was quite a weird day in New Orleans for us Sunday morning.
Is there a lot of damage as a result?
There absolutely is. Unfortunately, this is something that we are finding ourselves growing more and more used to, but that does not make it feel any better when you have hundreds, if not thousands, of cars across the city that are taking on water, and you get several inches of water in homes yesterday at in certain spots around the city. A friend of mine, is going to have to replace a floor yet again for the second time in 2 years, that kind of thing.
And this is not even hurricane season yet. That doesn't start for another month or so. How unusual is it to get this kind of flooding at this time of year?
It is unusual, but, you know, the sort of, in recent memory, the thing that really stands out to us is August 5th, 2017, when the city just got completely dumped with water. And we ended up, at the time, my husband and I lived across the Mississippi River in a different part of town called Mid-City. I had waist-deep water in front of my house. And so since that happened, we've been dealing with not only infrastructural issues in New Orleans, but also just, you know, as climate change is happening, we're getting more and more water dumped on the city, you know, as happens around the country. And so this is something that it's unusual, but it's becoming normal, which is scary in and of itself.
So it's sunny today, right? So you get a little, yes, a little break now, but there is more rain in the forecast this week.
There is, definitely. And so, you know, what was unusual about overnight Sunday was we got between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m., we got more than 5 inches of rain dumped on the city, you know, in a really short amount of time. And so when you have that much rain getting dumped on a city, our pump system just can't keep up. And so we're consistently having to keep an eye on the National Weather Service and everything, and just trusting that our very old creaky pipes are gonna have to do right by us until we can make some infrastructural improvements in New Orleans.
That's Chelsea Braisted, a city columnist for NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune. Chelsea, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this week, San Francisco could become the first U.S. city to ban the use of facial recognition by police and other city agencies, the latest backlash against the proliferation of surveillance technology in daily life. But a growing body of researchers say privacy advocates should be just as concerned about digital surveillance by companies, or what they've deemed surveillance capitalism. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us, as he does each Monday, from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
So I just spoke with a woman the other day who was very angry to find out that JetBlue was letting her board her plane using facial recognition as a form of ID provided to JetBlue by the government without her knowledge. Where else do we see what people are calling surveillance capitalism?
Just about everywhere there's an internet connection. When we go online to shop, to search, to talk to friends on Facebook Messenger or Instagram or Twitter, we are surveilled. We understand that we are in an essentially a bargain with these companies, that we get to use their cheap or even free services. And in exchange, we give up certain rights, like the right to essentially have our digital activities monitored. But then even when we're offline, surveillance continues. It continues with pharmacy rewards cards, with smart devices like smart refrigerators and smart toys, with our smartphones themselves. We're all participants in a grand experiment of surveillance that has a simple equation at the heart of it, that we essentially get to use cheap or even free services and products, and in exchange, the companies that provide these services and products keep them cheap by collecting our data and doing something else with it.
And does it make a difference to you if it is, let's say, a police camera that is monitoring you, or if it's a camera that belongs to a company?
To me, it makes a huge difference. I make a huge distinction between government surveillance and corporate surveillance. But the more interesting question, I think, is whether or not it makes a difference to most Americans. So this is a question that I asked in my podcast, Crazy Genius with The Atlantic. I was interested in how the definition of privacy has changed so much in American history. So in the late 19th century, when you have the invention of the telegraph and the telephone, privacy was really about information. It was about whether or not our nosy neighbors were spying on us, because communication that used to be private was now being conducted over public wires. Then in the 20th century, the definition of privacy changed. It became not about nosy neighbors, but about nosy government. It was about McCarthyism and fears of George Orwell's 1984. Then in the 21st century, the definition of privacy has changed again. It's not about information and nosy neighbors. It's not necessarily just about government surveillance. It's about corporate surveillance. It's about this fleet of products and services that have that grand bargain at the center of them. So for many people, I think they might still hold on to a 20th century definition of privacy. But a lot of the privacy advocates that we're seeing talking today are thinking about a 21st century definition of the term.
Well, and as you say, though, a lot of Americans don't seem to care about all of this surveillance by companies. what is the actual harm to an individual who, let's say, gives up their personal data in exchange for something like Google Maps?
To be honest, I don't know. And I think it's very, very difficult for anybody to say that they know exactly what the ultimate harm of giving up this data is. And that ignorance, I think, is a part of the problem. When a lot of Americans, thousands of them, were participating in a personality quiz on Facebook in 2016, they might have thought, what's the worst thing that could possibly happen with participating in a personality quiz? But that personality quiz that I'm referring to was being conducted by an organization called Cambridge Analytica that used the information that Americans gave up in that quiz, connected it with their friend groups to create psychographic profiles of voters to mobilize some voters to vote for Donald Trump, to demobilize other voters that might have seemed more likely to vote for Hillary Clinton, and thus threatened to make a lot of Americans, not just those that participated in the quiz, but many, many more, millions, question what was at the heart of American democracy, whether someone else was pulling the strings and whether our vote actually counted the way that it should have been counted. And so I think it's important to say that what's happening at the end of this equation isn't always clear, but we shouldn't take that ignorance as a sign that we should necessarily trust all these companies. Many times, I think we should then ask the next question, what do our laws say these companies can do once the data has been collected?
Well, what can be done? What are people supposed to do about this? And is there any escaping surveillance capitalism in our daily lives, or does there need to be new regulation?
I think there does need to be new regulation. I think that regulation should do three key things. Number one, it should be harder for us to give up our most precious data. So many times as you go around the internet, you see these OK buttons. Are you all right with our privacy, with our terms of service? OK. Are you all right with our privacy terms? OK. And we just click OK, 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 because we can't possibly spend time reading all of this fine print. So one, it should be harder to give up our data. Two, it should be harder for the companies that we are in a bargain with to sell it. And third, it should be harder for third-party organizations, particularly political campaigns, to buy it. Because the biggest threat here is not the individual threat. It's not like individual robbery. The biggest threat I say in the podcast is it's like climate change, a diffuse threat. You can't connect a hurricane to any one individual's failure to recycle. Rather, you understand that you're a part of a larger system. Mm-hmm. And it's all of our data emissions contributing to what is essentially a climate change of the internet. And that is the ultimate danger of digital surveillance today.
You know, there's a saying, if you're not paying for it, you're not the customer, you're the product being sold. And I know that there's a researcher you spoke with, Derek, who said this, I love this quote, we're not the ivory. We are not what is poached. We are the carcass that is left behind. We will link people to your piece about surveillance capitalism in the Atlantic at hereandnow.org. And check out Crazy Genius. Derek, thanks.
Thank you.
Thirty-year-old James Lewis Jordan is facing charges in southwestern Virginia that he attacked two hikers on the Appalachian Trail over the weekend, killing one man, wounding a woman who escaped. With county deputies located Jordan using an SOS signal sent by the hiker who ultimately died. Other hikers had encountered Jordan on the trail and said he seemed mentally ill. Brian King is with the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. Brian, Jordan was actually known to hikers as a possible threat?
Very much so. He was arrested 2 weeks before this in Unicoi County, Tennessee, because hikers complained to the local authorities that he was threatening them with an axe or with this big knife that he had.
Yeah.
And so he was arrested there.
And we understand that he did plead guilty to charges of, let's say, drug possession and criminal impersonation. He was giving deputies a fake ID after he had this confrontation with hikers in Tennessee near the North Carolina border, but released. Oh, that makes your heart sick there.
He pleaded guilty, but the hikers didn't get off the trail to testify, so the prosecutors couldn't really go to trial without the testimony of the victims.
And yet people were aware of him, so we understand he had been given the nickname Sovereign, and people were aware of him.
Most of the time, other hikers give somebody a trail name. A lot of hikers don't know anybody's real name. They just go by their trail names. Mm. Now, whether he gave it to himself or somebody gave it to him, I don't know.
Yeah. And then we come to this moment where there were actually four hikers that he confronted, And they ran, and he chased two of them. Horrifying. Explain to us, how deep in the trail was this? How far are you from people or from help when something like this happens?
Well, if I am certain of the location, they were probably 7 to 8 miles from Interstate 81, but it's a rural valley, and there are a lot of hikers in that area right now. But the two hikers ran north, is from what we can determine in that sense, and it was at night.
Well, and it's alleged that Jordan attacked them with a knife. Yes. The man was killed, but before he died, he hit an SOS alert on his iPhone, and that's ultimately how the area in which this attack took place was found by officials, and ultimately they tracked down Jordan. What kinds of SOS signals can hikers use?
A lot of them use a device called Spot, and that's the brand name, but there are a couple other brands. When you camp for the night, you can push one button, and it tells the people at home that you're safe and sound for the night and where you are. There's another button that goes to a dispatch center in Texas that there's an emergency. They contact the nearest local authority and send them out to help.
Look, this has just been a horror for hikers, because once you're on the trail, if you're trying to complete that 2,100 miles, you're going to keep going. And knowing that there was a danger like this must have just been horrific. But how rare is it?
Oh, it's extremely rare. I mean, in terms of murders on the trail in the last 45 years, there have been 8 incidents with 10 victims. Mm. The last one was in 2011.
Well, and it's a very dangerous hike just because of the natural dangers. I mean, we know recently a woman very near the end just veered off the path and she died. Mm-hmm. But what would you say to people who they have, you know, family and loved ones out there on the trail right now? We know there are blogs you can follow to hear about news like this if somebody was concerned about someone on the trail. What can people do?
They really need to keep their street smarts with them when they're there. Now, I mean, I don't know how you prevent against evil with a knife like this. But, you know, be wary of strangers. Don't tell people where you're going. Don't give your plans except to the people at home. And really trust your gut. You know, people go to the trail to get away from bad things in the world, whether it's low-level stress or anything else. But they got to remember that the world can still get to the trail. It's completely accessible.
Well, also, would you recommend we see that there are blogs like Trek?
Yes. That's one way. There are various Facebook groups. Even before smartphones and everything else, the grapevine on the trail was very strong. It was unbelievable how fast news could go up and down the trail. Mm. Now it's a lot faster. So the hikers that are out there now knew about this guy, and they protect each other. Mm. The danger there is, even when you're hiking with others, that you let your guard down too much.
Or there's just something insurmountable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know how you totally prevent against that.
Well, the young woman in the attack played dead and then got up and ran away. Brian King of the Appalachian Trail Conservancy, thank you so much for filling in on this really disturbing story. Yeah.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate your calling.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.